living with conservation land may be really wonderful, but many Alaskans will tell you the politics can drive you nuts. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today we continue the personal view of history with Dr. Mike Holloway and talk about public lands. Call statewide, toll-free, 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, or email talk@alaskapublic.org. As the Wilderness Act nears 50, we'll be looking at what it has done on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, before there was an Alaska Lands Act, before there was Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, there was a new Wilderness Act. It's been 50 years since the Wilderness Act was put together. We're not quite to the 50th anniversary of its signing, but we will be soon. And each of those has had an influence on public lands in Alaska. A few weeks ago, we did a show on William Henry Seward, and we talked with the author, his biographer, about how Mr. Seward came up with the idea of manifest destiny even before there was such a concept. He was one of the first to envision the westward expansion of the nation, which ended up reaching its finish in Alaska. And that's where we are. People come to Alaska and get stuck here. People come and find that they can't leave, that there's something about it, something that gets into their dreams, something that they can't find anyplace else, and they come back. And one of those people is with us today. He's still here today, lives down the road, down the Seward Highway in Rainbow. It's J. Michael Holloway. Dr. Holloway, welcome to Talk of Alaska. How are you today?
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
You will be able to tell pretty quickly on the show that Mike has Parkinson's. Sometimes his speech is halting. It'll come out in little bursts and so forth like that. And we're just going to coexist with it because Mike has told his story, or one of his stories, in this book, a new book from Epicenter Press called Dreaming Bears. And the full title is Dreaming Bears, a Gwich'in Indian Storyteller, a Southern Doctor, a Wild Corner of Alaska. We'll be talking about all those things. And you say, well, what's the connection with wilderness? Lots. Because wilderness is country on its own, and designated protected wilderness is something else again. Then it has to be managed, and that means challenges, especially in a time of change, and especially in the state of Alaska. And we'll be examining the many colors of the application of the Wilderness Act in Alaska with three youthful producers who have been out in the field at protected lands in Alaska. And we'll be going to their segments at various points through the program. Your calls are welcome. You may remember Dr. Holloway. He may have operated on you. He was an orthopedic surgeon at the Native Medical Center for many years. And if you'd just like to say hello, feel free. If you're up there in Fairbanks, if you have relatives up in that country and you just want to give them a shout out, that's fine too. Because we're talking about some pretty interesting people. And that is, I think, wouldn't you say that the reason that you wrote this book is because of the people you knew up in Gwich'in country?
Definitely. It was my association and long-term relationship with an elderly Gwich'in couple that changed my life.
So how old were you when you came to Alaska and decided with your brother and a buddy to try and walk across the Arctic?
Yeah, we were pretty presumptuous. I was 21. We planned to drive to the end of the road and start walking and spend the summer living off the land, but we found out we more lived off the Indians.
You did indeed. So what, you got a welcome when you started getting back up into the country. You were actually welcomed.
It was amazing. We drove to Circle and tried to get a ride across the river, and we asked what for. I said, we want to walk to Fort Yukon. I didn't tell them we were going to try to walk to Wiseman. And
they have a road now.
They have a great laugh over there at the store.
I'll bet they did.
And nobody walks across the Yukon Flats. And so they advised we fly in. We flew into Vinitai. I'd planned just to hit the ground and apologize for being on their land and keep going. But everybody in the village met us at the plane and introduced us one by one. And Chief Doris come down to his place, and when he found out what we were planning to do, I thought we needed to go upriver by a place called Cairo on the map. And
which hadn't existed for a while.
He said, how come? I said, so we can buy more rice and beans and food in the store there. He hesitated, and he said, nobody lived there a long time. Maybe 1914, 1913. So he knew we were out of our element. He directed us up to this elderly Wichin couple on the east fork of the Chandelier. And they were very gracious, but everyone was very friendly and outgoing and welcomed us.
So, did you live off the land?
We did. A lot of it was at their place on the river that he called Gold Camp. And we learned to set rabbit snares and mainly caught fish. We learned on grayling and rabbits. It was a high rabbit year. We were very fortunate. We learned to set snares so we could catch 4 or 5 a night.
So why, do you have any idea why they were so hospitable to you? These must have seen, maybe it was because there were three of you or something, because they must have seen stuff like this before.
It's hard to understand why they were so open, but the Gretchen described themselves as a hospitality people. And they'd been viewed by some of the anthropologists as a remote people. But it's still amazing to me how kind and generous they were.
So the heart of it was really Johnny Frank and Sarah Frank.
Right, that was my... Once I met them, I knew it was a rare thing. Johnny was 81 when we first met. And he and Sarah had been through starvation times and had lost many children with disease and accidents. But it was definitely about them.
And it was for you white guys from civilization, coming into this, flying into this essentially, and walking some distance into it. Did it take a while to dawn on you that we're talking real starvation here? We're talking real hard times, what these people went through, that it's just a a really kind of a different universe, going all the way back to the flu epidemic and the diseases that came in before that. They're so isolated, really, that these things take a while getting there, and they're all living part of the history.
It definitely happened in their lifetime. Sarah recounted when she's living up near where the Ark Village is now. When she went to Fort Yukon during the Salvation time with her family, and from Arctic Village down to Fort Yukon, their dogs were dying from starvation, and somebody met them partway out of Fort Yukon and brought food. And so she remembers that both in the starvation time, and when she got to Fort Yukon, that was the first time she'd ever seen white people. And she's very scared of these white people.
So, to clarify, this is a situation where even the dogs were starving, and they barely made it. And when people came out to meet them.
That's great.
Did you find personally that you and your brother and your buddy, that you discovered inner resources that you maybe didn't know you had before this experience?
Right, I was a pretty hot-tempered young man, and that's probably the single biggest influence of my life is Johnny's the situation where I spoke to my son, and Johnny told me, "Don't get mad, no use." And that's probably the single biggest influence I had on my life was they had been through so many tragedies, and yet they were very kind, generous people with no bitterness.
I'm still trying to figure that out. You refer to it several times in the book, "Don't get mad, no use." Seems like it got results. I mean, what do you mean, no use?
Yeah, that you can accomplish the same goal without getting mad.
I got it. Yeah. We're speaking with Dr. Michael Holloway. He's author of Dreaming Bears. And it's essentially reminiscences of his time up in Gwich'in country. Johnny and Sarah became godparents of his children. He's written all this up. He has Parkinson's. He retired from the Indian Health Service the last time, I guess. Early part of this century.
2001.
Yeah. So this is some of this was written some time ago, and some of it has been caught up on now, and it has some wonderful color photographs of the people and the era up there on the Chandalar Vinatai Arctic Village, Fort Yukon, primarily, and that's what we kind of been talking about. It's Talk of Alaska. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. Remember, it's statewide, any place across the state. Maybe Mike operated on you and you'd like to say hi. That would be just fine. I'd like to go to one of the segments now. We have several segments produced by youthful producers about public lands and wilderness in Alaska. And I think what we'll do this time is with the Reed Mogdons, we'll make our way up to the Northwest Arctic and how the wilderness affects people there. Yeah, sure. Or maybe we will at some point. Does it not play? Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay. Well, if it doesn't work.
Let me check the format.
All right. Okay. Well, that's not going to work, so we'll continue to improvise, which I'm pretty good at. So, Margie, I don't think you've hardly spoken up at first at all, but I like calling you. You're here to assist and help Mike get his message across.
It's a pleasure to be here, Steve.
And you guys have been in Rainbow for a while.
30 years for me, but longer than that for Mike.
And this is where you decided to build, just up the highway from Anchorage and up in that valley, which is really, as I understand, it's mostly Art Davidson's land, and it's kind of an inholding in Chugach Park, I think, right?
Yeah, Art Davidson started and set it up the, but it's commonly owned land.
So now it's commonly owned.
Right.
Everybody's together up there in Rainbow.
Yeah, the population's kind of dwindled over the years as we get older.
Mm-hmm.
And we migrate to New Mexico in the summer and winter now.
Uh-huh.
So we're up here for the summers.
Well, you're a southern boy after all.
Yeah, it is. We don't have indoor plumbing. We have gravity feed water from the creek in the summer.
You're kidding.
It's a bit strenuous for me now.
It's also kind of, as I recall, kind of up and down, getting in and out of there.
Yes, you euphemistically called a valley.
Okay. Well, I believe we're ready to play our first thing and go out and visit the Northwest Arctic with Reed Mugduns.
In the Wilderness Act, wilderness is recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. But that definition just doesn't make sense to rural Alaskans, many of whom are descended from people who have lived on the land and used its resources for thousands of years. Pete Schaefer, a lifelong resident of Kotzebue and member of its tribal, was surprised the first time he read the Wilderness Act.
I was taken aback by almost the first statement in there, which said man is an intruder and all that kind of stuff. And I thought that was really contrary to the Inupiaq, aka the native worldview in terms of being part of ecosystems.
Willie Goodwin, also a lifetime Kotzebue resident, feels similarly.
We're part of the landscape. We utilize the land, everything that it provides for our people for thousands of years. We still utilize the same resources out there.
Alex Whiting, environmental specialist for the native village of Kotzebue, says the value of Northwest Alaska's designated wilderness areas is less in their unrestricted natural character or their aesthetic appeal. Their greater value comes, rather, from their ability to provide.
My perspective is that wilderness up here, first and foremost, is an economic driver in the sense that the resources that wilderness produces allow people to make a living. Wilderness grows food.
Federally designated wilderness areas operate under different rules in Alaska. Dan Stevenson, chief ranger with the National Park Service in Kotzebue, explains.
We have hunting just about 12 months of the year in some form of consumptive harvest within the parklands, whether that's berry picking, firewood gathering, caribou hunting, moose hunting, trapping. All those different activities occur throughout the year, and it all looks and feels the same, at least in my opinion, and no fences, no markers, no signs. So it's very easy, or you can easily cross federal boundaries and not even know it, whether you're on BLM, National Park Service land, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service land, state land, or NANA land. It's really easy.
Given the similarities in rules and lack of boundary markers, many local people don't distinguish wilderness from any other type of land, or even know it's there.
I bet you would be hard-pressed to find somebody in the region that actually knew there was wilderness areas here, or that could even point out where the wilderness areas were.
So if wilderness areas are indistinguishable and few people know their boundaries, what's the point of them? For many rural Alaskans, their biggest worry is that future large-scale development will threaten the ability of the land to provide food. So while wilderness areas may be indistinguishable now, that might not be the case forever, says Alex Whiting.
A
Looking into the future, what would you say are the greatest threats to those values associated with wilderness, those resources?
Habitat fragmentation.
Pete Schaefer sees risks as well.
One of the major concerns that we have, I mean, as Native people, is the fact that, you know, there have been significant development already. Red Dog is an example of the mining activity. So I think there's an understanding that there's some areas that need to be protected.
Willie Goodwin thinks development will eventually come, and he's happy protected lands might help traditional ways of life continue.
I recognize that the country will probably need much of the minerals up here, but we do have a lot of parks that we have four parks in the region that I'm glad that are here. I'm glad they're in place to make sure that our people utilize the land, you know.
Willie voices what most rural Alaskans believe. Wilderness areas don't exist to ensure Alaska has places where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. They are there, rather, to ensure that a way of life lives on in which man is part of the natural world. Reporting from Kotzebue, this is Reed Magdans.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're with J. Michael Holloway, author of Dreaming Bears, a Gwich'in Indian storyteller, a Southern doctor, a wild corner of Alaska. And Mike, I guess that feature probably resonated a bit with you because you were a lobbyist for subsistence rights at one point. You actually went to Health Service and went to Washington to lobby on the way back in the D2 days.
Right, Steve. I was a village Washington D.C. liaison, so I would travel to different areas of the state where there was talk of various designated changes. And excuse my hesitancy.
That's fine.
Yeah. So wilderness was a big factor. Because I was trying to see what the local communities wanted to do about protecting the land around them. And there wasn't a lot of discussion at first with the villages. And when you didn't discuss it, it was a very negative viewpoint because it's exactly of what we just heard. And these posters had said, wilderness is a place where man visits but does not live. And that immediately struck the natives absolutely wrong. So one of the big factors in the D2 bill was to get wilderness protection with as a political designation to prevent road, but adopted so it allowed local use of local resources, like firewood and hunting, and that was quite an issue. And once that was adopted into the changes of the Wilderness Act as applied to Alaska, and Gwich'in and other groups started to realize that the biggest factor was keep out roads. The roads were the most damaging to wildness. And I say wildness because we walked from Minnetown up about, we went up about 85, 90 miles to a lake up there and back. And to me, it was natural land. It was wildness. And I think it needed political wilderness to protect that wildness.
I think that's an interesting way to put it, yeah, political, right. So I would take it then that you would favor wilderness protection for the 1002 area, as they call it, the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge, because it would still allow for the subsistence.
We definitely thought, since it had been designated as a Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, it was protected, and we were, the environmental effort in the D2 bill was to try to change that to wilderness with politically. And they added to the acreage, but without just making that a refuge. But the shock came in the spring of 78, when suddenly a newspaper headline said 1002 area was designated opening. And the rest of it, the refuge was going to the wilderness. But that was when I was able to, with several other environmentalists, Bob Childress and Paul Lowe, we had an immediate reaction to reading the newspaper that morning. And Bob realized that they hadn't included Native Voice. And so, because I was working for Rural Community Action Program as a subsistence advocate, I was able to travel to the villages and inform people in Vientiane, especially we got the immediate involvement of Jonathan Solomon, who was a Native leader who became tenacious in protecting the 1002 area.
Yeah, and that's a compelling part of the book. For those people who are familiar with the issue, I would refer them to your book, Dreaming Bears. I think some of this history has never been written down before, of exactly how things worked with the done deal on the 1002 area in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. A very, very interesting account, and probably more than we can go into in the detail that I would like to at this point in the show. Michael Holloway is our guest. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org, and I think we'll go to another one of these features where our youthful producers have gone out to parts of Alaska to show us how the Wilderness Act has worked out in those situations. So now let's head out to Lake Clark with Nikki Navio.
The constant sound of an Alaskan bush plane engine fills my ears as we fly through Lake Clark Pass. I'm Nikki Navio. Soon, the landscape opens to a magnificent deep blue lake surrounded by snow-capped mountains in the middle of an Alaskan July. Nondalton, south of Lake Clark National Reserve, is the destination.
The Dena'ina name is Kuzjukvana. My name is Karen Ivanoff. I was born and raised in Nondalton, Alaska, and lived here most of my life.
The Lake Clark area is part of one of the largest spawning grounds of wild sockeye salmon in the world. The salmon make their annual journey from the salty waters of Bristol Bay up the Kuujjuaq River to Lake Iliamna, then to Lake Clark. Some only make it as far as the Ivanoff's fish camp. Eugene Ivanoff is Karen's nephew.
We would dry fish for eating for ourselves, salt it, smoke it. There was fish buried underground. So it was an extremely important thing back when we didn't have the resources that we have today. And it's still a subsistence practice.
Kylan Wasson and Tristan Ivanoff are some of the younger participants out at fish camp.
You just get here and then you set up the camp. As you get farther into it, then you do like fishing and seining and that sort of stuff.
Sometimes it's buggy here, too, and sometimes we go swimming.
The Ivanoff Fish Camp is several miles south of the border of Lake Clark National Park and Preserve. According to ANILCA, national parks within the state offer protection of opportunities for traditional practices by local rural Alaskans. John Branson is a park historian for Lake Clark and has been living in the region since before the lake became designated as a national park.
There was a skepticism, but over time, I think the Park Service has proven that they were respectful and wanted to continue customary and traditional subsistence for local rural residents. And so I think that that has helped, win support. by local people.
Karen Ivanoff, who works as a cultural anthropologist for the park, says the Park Service and natives both have the goal of protecting the land and its resources. Natives have done that since long before the park was established.
Native people had their own system of conservation and preservation of the natural world, and they had their own, you know, what is termed in the Western way as resource management. And we had our ancestors had our way of caring for the environment, and without that care, over the years, the land wouldn't be as pristine and clean and in the way it is today.
Today, many local natives willingly share the responsibility.
Tribal council chairman Bill Trefon told me on more than one occasion, he said that one of the best things that ever happened to Lake Clark was the creation of this park. And the reason he said that that was important in a positive way was that it helped assure that there would be a large land mass unspoiled in wilderness that would allow the people of Nundalton to continue their customary and traditional subsistence lifestyle off the resources.
I know we're also grateful that a lot of the land up around Lake Clark will be preserved and protected for future generations. That's really important.
The symbiotic relationship between the land and its collective people help keep the fish running up to Lake Clark and maintain this little haven of nature known as Fish Camp for one family. I'm Nikki Navio.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology, provimaging.com. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
The interweaving of people and the land, the subject today on Talk of Alaska. Dr. J. Michael Holloway is with us, the author of Dreaming Bears, and we've been talking about his time with the Gwich Inn. He has a website, an author page, J. Michael Holloway, just Holloway, H-O-L-L-O-W-A-Y. Just jam all that together, jmichaelholloway.com, and you'll find him. And also a Facebook facility. I'm not quite sure how you navigate to those, but got one of those called Dreaming Bears. You can probably search that out pretty easily. And I believe we'll provide links on our website for any of those if people want to pursue this very fascinating history. And I'm so glad, Mike, that you have taken the trouble to write all this down for us. I'd like to go to some phone calls that have been coming in, if it's all right with you.
Certainly.
All right, let's go to Jim. Joins the program from Caribou Creek. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jim.
Hello, Dr. Mike. This is Jim Hitchcock. I built your cabin in Rainbow Valley.
Hi, Jim. We were wondering what happened to you.
it really, really did bring some great memories back when you started talking, and I remember that whole process of building that cabin with you, and I think what I remember the best is that trip when you took me up to visit Johnny Frank and Sarah at Gold Camp, and I don't even remember the year it was, but it was a long time ago. That was a really a life-changing thing for me.
Yeah, I knew you needed a native viewpoint of things. Having grown up on a homestead out in the valley, when that trip was very special to me, Jim. And of course, you I think of you all the time because I live in your home that you built.
Well, I appreciate that, and I've thought about you quite often since then, but I've followed some of what you've been doing. I'm going to rush down and get your book too. You've done some amazing things and done a lot of good for a lot of people.
Yeah, Jim, I think there's an event coming up, isn't there? Do you know, Marty, can you tell me about that?
On May 18th, Mike will be at the museum from 1 o'clock to 2:30 p.m.
May 18th, 1 o'clock to 2:30. I will do my very best to be there.
I'd love to see you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, Jim, thanks so much for getting motivated to the phone. That was great.
Well, I couldn't help it. It's really great to talk to Mike, and thank you for having this service here. So we'll talk to you later. Bye.
All right, Jim. Thanks so much for that call. Hey, letting us all listen in on that. That's really makes for really special radio. Let's go to Herman. Joins the program from Antioch. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Herman.
Yeah, good morning. Interesting program. Thank you for having that person on there who tell us about a long time ago. We were just talking about that on a talk show here around Bethel area, and they're talking about bears too, but that's another story. And I was going to tell you what I've been through. I've been here 60 years. I'm half Eskimo, quarter Indian, and quarter German. It's been a unique perspective on how important the land is to us. I lived in a time before there were storm scenes, and we used to be nomads. We used to live off the land. And right now, here in this area, they almost completely closed us to fishing, and they almost tell us that we have to only fish with dip nets. But they changed it because from Antioch on down, it's part of a federal reserve or something, and we're cut our customer tradition, usually we can fish. But I feel sorry for these people above us who aren't part of it. But I'll tell you what I see, how the influences of another culture is coming and affecting our, I think, Native, how we depend on the land and how we can work together. I always tell my kids or people to take the best of both worlds. I'll tell you, when the white men, I'm saying white men in a nice way, not a bad way, but when they first came, they taught our ancestors, they used to beat their hands when they talked in their own language. They took their language away, and they taught them a false, how you say it, religion. Because there's another true religion that when Christ Jesus came, we're supposed to believe in him. And this book also talks about healing our land. And we need to teach our people to not believe that way anymore. And it say, if my people who are called my people will turn from their ways, he will heal their land. And right now, we can work together. We're having a King Salmon problem. And we tell them, I'm glad, thank the Lord, we're able to fish, but let a lot of them big King Salmon go. In 5 years, I'll come back, and we'll have a lot of them. And Congressman Don Young, he mentioned Anelka. He said, too bad it didn't address subsistence. You know, subsistence is really important to us, and Telstra and these all other corporations, they give us dividends, but what it's doing, it's breaking our ties to the land. The only way they can build a house is depend on a government program. They should allow people to go back and build their own homes with our land, logs, and have a garden or further ground. But the way it's going now, you know, it's got to be changed, but I'll tell you how this book ends. You know, there's going to be a new world, and we need to do the best we can to protect what we have and use the right path. They taught us them people, Goshawks, they come, they taught us something that's a little different, but there's others that come that takes things the right way. We need to work together and protect this earth and use it the right way and let them people know that we depend on this land to feed our families. You know, don't take it away from us.
Herman, Herman, thank you. Thank you. It's very eloquent, as always. And I want to call on Mike to respond to that, because really, Johnny Frank would also really look very closely at the Bible and the Christian religion. It's very, very important to Johnny Frank. Wouldn't you say, Mike?
Definitely. When I first was up there, we were helping him build a new log cabin. And I asked him what he thought about God, because that would have been a very big factor in my southern raising. And he looked at me while he filled his pipe. He said, tree, little tree, grow big. I see geese. I see animals. Sure, I know there's the God. So he interspersed his respect for the land and living creatures. And definitely integrated his own view of philosophy. He trapped for 40 years and read the Bible 4 times. And one of his delightful stories was when he'd go to Fort Yukon. Hudson Silk, who was archdeacon of the Yukon of the Episcopal Church, were trying to stump him. Johnny was trying to stump him. He'd see if Stark knew certain biblical phrases. But it's definitely integrated into his life.
I would say, he would, he would, as you say in your title, a Gwich'in Indian storyteller. He told stories, and some of those stories, it'd be like about Samson, It'd be about Joseph.
One of the instances up there is when my friend who went with me the second time I was up there in 62. Johnny was going to relate a Gwich'in story about coming back to life, saying Jesus was the only one who did that. And he turned to Willie and said, you know Jesus? And Willie said, no, because he didn't understand him. He would have been raised in the Southern Baptist Church with a very strict religious mother. And I could hardly keep him laughing, but so Johnny went through telling him a brief story about Jesus and then related that to an Indian who died and came back to life several times.
He was leading him to Jesus. A boy brought up religious, leading him to Jesus, that's something.
Yeah, I thought that was, still getting to know Johnny. Because my real value was going up there over the years and his influence on my raising of my son. And my son did many trips with me up there too.
You know, it's so interesting because you're a whole family of doctors. I guess your father was a doctor. Your father's father was a doctor. And now you for some reason, chose to stay in the medical path despite all this Alaska stuff and so forth. You know, you ended up practicing, and now your son. No, he didn't do that?
My son does research in chemistry that's very complicated.
Ah, you went off the technical end then.
Well, no, yeah, I was fourth generation small town doctor.
Yeah.
None of them were university people or whatever they were, mostly in rural areas of the South.
Right. Let's take a call here from Jim in Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Mike Holloway. Jim?
Hello.
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 You're on, Jim.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, Mike and Margie, this is Jim in Fairbanks. Too much to recall all the Anoka battles and whatnot, so I just want to welcome you both. And you might, Margie, or tell what the book signing venues are in Fairbanks and dates as well. And I look forward to seeing both of you with Suzanne. It's great to hear you. I haven't read the book yet. Anxious to read it. I was fortunate to meet Sarah Frank in the middle '80s. And she was, of course, pretty far along, but I traveled there with Jonathan Solomon at that point. Anyway, welcome. It's great to hear you both.
It's great to hear you, Jim. you're definitely in the book because you went with me.
Oh.
To the fringe of the earth, to the villages, yeah. The first time. So.
Those were the days.
Those were the days. It's kind of fun to be watching all this go by here on Talk of Alaska. I'll toss this in from Frank, who says, Alaska's been my home since 1961. When I first came up here as a teen, I was invited on a hunt with my uncle in the Alaska Range. 61, just like you, Mike. It was a life-changing event and inspired me to get out in the Alaskan wilderness countless times since then. For me and my family, many of my friends, wilderness is where we've received spiritual nourishment. For me personally, it's been a source of inspiration for my poetry and other writings. Without wilderness, wild lands, and wild rivers, I would be half the person I have become. I hope it is protected and preserved forever so that my children and grandchildren can receive the same inspiration and nourishment it has given me. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
And this email now coming in for Dr. Mike Holloway from Alan says, Matsi Chu to Mike Holloway for writing Dreaming Bears. I'm enjoying the stories of my relatives, Johnny and Sarah. Our elders are precious to us, and their understanding of the connection we have to the earth and animals is more important today than ever. We are dependent on a healthy environment to sustain us. We need to make sure our descendants, seven generations into the future, will have a healthy and thriving planet to live on. It is up to us today. And from Alan Hayton.
Thanks, Alan.
Let's go ahead and there was mention of a Fairbanks appearance too.
We have three events in Anchorage and three in Fairbanks, and those are listed on the author website, jmichaelholloway.com. But the first one in Fairbanks is Thursday, May 29th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Alaska Geographic Bookstore in the Morris Thompson Cultural and Visitor Center.
Great. And the Anchorage one again is coming up quicker.
The first one in Anchorage, May 18th, this Sunday, 1 to 2:30 at the Anchorage Museum.
Okay, let's go to Fairbanks now, and Princess joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Mike Holloway, Princess.
Thank you. I also want to kind of echo Alan's sentiments It's just really nice to see some of our history here in writing, and just wanted to say Masit Cho for all of Mike's hard years in helping us, you know, protect our subsistence way of life. And, you know, I grew up around this issue, talking about protection of the calving grounds for the porcupine caribou herd in the 1002 area. And now I'm the executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee. And so I appreciated seeing this history. And I guess my question really, as we continue now, we're going on, you know, our community's been working for over 30 years on this issue, and the steering committee, we just had our 25th anniversary last year. And I'm just wondering, back in 1978, if you thought that we'd be working for so long on protection, permanent protection for the 1002 area.
As John Muir pointed out many years ago, it's a continuous fight, because there'll always be some, I hesitate to say it, but some greed involved in developing these lands. And you're right, Johnny Frank was very adamant. He spoke with Tanachi several hearings, and realized it'd have to be a constant fight. But he said, the land, we need the land. Money is like candy. And if we take care of the land, it'll take care of us.
You know,
the major part of that was respect for the land and all the creatures, including us.
Princess, you can probably verify this for me, but from what I've heard is that Gwich'in elders simply do not go to that area because they consider it so sacred it's not to be gone to.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
And so there's it creates a kind of a paradox, because it's hard to convince management, public policy forces, as to what the delicacy of that habitat might be in specifics, like insect avoidance, predator avoidance, so forth like that.
Well, there's been so many studies on that area, but just if you look at the fact that 40,000 calves are born in that area en masse, meaning that they're all born within a 2 to 3 day period of time, and birth is a sacred thing, period. Creation is a sacred thing. And so I just, you know, when I think about that, to me, that's just a miracle of life. And it's just common sense that you wouldn't want any development anywhere near that area.
Well, thanks for your call.
Yeah, Masit Cho, thank you so much.
All right, great. This shout-out here from Bob in Sitka. We will miss him in Sitka and all of Southeast. All of the orthopedic care that he delivered over the years is still treasured. Bob in Sitka to Dr. Mike Holloway. Telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. Local call on Anchorage 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. So a lot of this book was written some time ago.
Probably 35 years ago.
And it just sat. So what propelled you to finally get it done?
From the first time I came up here, my mother started keeping all the letters and notes and everything. And she always thought I should write a book about it. But I just keep a good journal, because I valued highly my time with Johnny and Sarah and documented it from the first. And I always like listening to older people tell stories. And as you alluded to earlier, he was a master storyteller. And that was one of the first things that Abraham Christian, the chief in Venetai, told us was he knew lots of stories. and he loved to tell them. And I felt deeply grateful for having that exposure right from the first.
Yeah, it's a... You got some great stories in here, too, that are your stories. You got stories like that it happened because of the interaction between the two cultures. The 1002 thing is just one, you know, outstanding historic example. But there's a number of other things, like when you discover environmentalists, you didn't even know what it was. You know, he said, what is the Sierra Club anyway? Well, I'm for it then. I mean, that's just crazy. And the story of the skin boat, all the detail of a skin boat. And then you got a picture of it in here, and you say, this may be the last skin boat, this kind of skin boat ever built in Alaska.
I think it's probably the last one that was functionally used. I think some of it made for museum displays and whatnot.
Yeah, of course, a different kind of skin boat's used by the whalers to this day.
Right.
But this one is like a moose hide. And
yeah, it was three moose hides that Sarah sewed together.
And anyway, when you get done with it, you just take the timbers out, dry out the hides, and roll them up.
Right. I actually rolled them up and tied them to threw them back in South Carolina, but they got wet in the rain.
Mm.
And they were not usable once we got there.
What about bear skin? You still have any bear skin?
The bear skin in the valley was at my brother's place in South Georgia, and he went in and heat got it, and it finally disintegrated, but I still have some bear toenails off of that bear.
Right. Well, I would think you probably got quite a bit of, like, beadwork and so forth from people down through the years just because of the nature of your work and people wanting to give you gifts.
I certainly have.
Yeah. All stashed up there, Rainbow.
Most prized among those is a moose skin stand that my Christian sister tanned and made into a rifle case. And it's a work of art.
I want to thank you for being with us so much. And Margie, thank you for your help. Next week on Talk of Alaska will be the state seismologist. We're talking earthquakes. Thanks.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network and by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.